Hi, I'm Henat Baba, host of Cross Currents. Just a few times a year, we ask for your support, and now is the time to do that. It's our spring membership campaign. So if you like what you hear on KALW, make a contribution now at KALW.org and click donate. Thank you.
KALW.
I think a lot of it had to do with just me looking for my place. And, you know, the boxing thing was always associated with my life, and I was burnt out. I was tired.
Andre Ward is a Bay Area boxing legend.
I'm dealing with anxiety. I'm dealing with depression. Didn't know it was that at the time. Those same generational patterns are in my life now.
Today, we hear about his struggles and victories in the personal fights of his life. Then an update on how San Francisco's handling drug overdoses.
I think that it's a political football. Unfair, yeah. It's definitely unfair to point to San Francisco and say that it's the worst place in the country for that sort of thing, but it's not doing very well, for sure.
How we got here and possible solutions. I'm Henat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Boxing fans know Andre Ward for his abilities in the ring. The boxing great from Oakland is an Olympic gold medalist and five-time world champion. He retired with an undefeated record in 2017. Now Andre Ward is talking about the other battles he overcame in his life. His parents were both drug addicts, and the instability at home led Andre to the streets. But he found his way onto a better path. Andre writes about this in his biography, Killing the Image, A Champion's Journey of Faith, Fighting, and Forgiveness. He spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
Andre Ward, welcome.
Happy to be here.
I am happy to have you here. You recently turned 40. Happy birthday. First of all, thank you for writing this book because I imagine that was not easy. And I can see this book, like a lot of youth would appreciate this book. I hope a lot of young people, especially maybe young people from your background or dealing with similar things that you dealt with, read it. You've been a national boxing champion since the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get your fighting spirit?
It was innate. You know, I was born with it, always been competitive. It also has to be cultivated throughout the years, you know, through just learning boxing and learning the mental side, the psychological side of it. And, you know, but it's hard to teach a kid how to want to hit a person back when they hit you. Some kids just don't have it in them, and that's fine. But I did. You know, I was a kid where I loved to win, and I was just very, very competitive. And if you hit me, I hit you back. And I just added the skill set of the sport to the mentality that I already had, and it made me a champion.
Did anybody ever try to fight you in middle school or high school, like knowing you were a boxer?
I had a handful. I mean, like maybe three run-ins at school, but my reputation preceded me. And I also wasn't a bully. My dad, you know, never went for that. And that wasn't in my heart. He was like, look, I better never hear about you misusing this gift that you have and what you're being taught. And I better never hear about you being a bully. If anything, you come to the aid and the rescue of somebody that is being bullied. So that was always my mentality. And that just kept me out the way.
And they knew not to mess with you, too. Folks know who not to mess with. And you mentioned your father, and you write about him a lot, Frank Ward, your late father. And I understand he has struggled with addiction. And what I loved about the story about your father was that even though he struggled, he still wanted to be present in your life. What did he teach you about manhood and love?
Perseverance. He was a man of detail. He cared about how I presented myself. You know, he taught me the value of standing up, shaking somebody's hand, looking them in the eye. And that stuff doesn't seem like much when you're a kid. But I've taken those same principles into many boardrooms, many business situations, many meetings, and those types of things, along with how to treat people. My dad introduced me to my faith, my Christian faith. And again, though he struggled, these principles were very, very important to him. You know, my dad was also a speaker and a preacher. And, you know, when he was in Victory Outreach drug program, you know, it's a Christian-based program.
Mm-hmm.
You start getting yourself cleaned up. If you have a desire to want to be in ministry and preach, they can start to raise you up. And my dad was a preacher in Victory Outreach. And so my dad gave me a lot.
And you also write about a lot about Virgil Hunter, your godfather and your coach. And he became a father figure in your life. What did he teach you about manhood?
I mean, he was the ram in the bush. You know, when my father passed, he stepped right in and he was already playing a dual father role even while my father was alive. And he picked up the teachings that my dad taught me, and he had his own sort of spin to it and flair to it, but it was very, very much in line with what my dad was already teaching me. You know, he was, you know, trying to encourage me as a young man when I thought sagging and, you know, having my braids long and stuff like that. And this is early 2000s, and I think, you know, dreads and braids are more accepted now, but he was old school, and he was like, I don't want you to get disqualified because they're judging you based on your appearance. And I would fight him on it like, man, they gotta accept me for who I am. And he would just always teach me the reality of life and society. Like, I feel you, but that ain't how the world sees it. I don't want you to miss out on a sponsorship or a business opportunity because they're looking at you like a thug or looking at you like you don't look the part. So he was very much in line with what my dad was saying in terms of presentation about how you conduct yourself. He's like, man, you know, one of his greatest sayings was, be a man about your business and a kid about your fun. Take care of your stuff. Handle your business. A kid about your fun once your business is handled.
I feel like your book is so much about love. I really do. I feel like it's so much about love and just how people poured into you. And, you know, your parents struggled with addiction. And I know I read, you know, you turned to the streets and you sold drugs and used drugs. And, you know, I grew up in East Oakland, so... And I had loved ones that did the same when they were men, when they were struggling and they didn't have the emotional support or just the awareness of what was going on. What was going on with your heart and your spirit and your mind that made you seek the streets, I guess, for comfort or understanding?
Yeah. I think a lot of it had to do with just me looking for my place. And, you know, the boxing thing was always associated with my life. And I was burnt out. I was tired. You know, and I've been doing this since I was 9, and now I'm 16, 17, going through adolescence, starting to realize everything that I was told about my parents' addictions and why they wasn't always there and different things wasn't always true. That starts to breed bitterness and resentment. And my heart, even though I was getting older, my heart was growing colder and didn't want much to do with my faith at that time. And I'm dealing with anxiety. I'm dealing with depression. Didn't know it was that at the time. And you start to, those same generational patterns are in my life now. Now, instead of me going to God or going to counseling or trying to talk through and work through my problems, I'm stuffing those things and I'm going to a quick fix. Weed, alcohol, drugs, you know, just trying to escape. And doing that and then being in the environment that I was in, it seemed like a good idea. That's the long way of saying I was searching. I was trying to figure it out. And unfortunately, at that time, that's what I chose to do.
But you turn things around and you quoted what my favorite book of the Bible, which is Proverbs 18:21, death, talking about death and the life are in the power of the tongue. And you talk about how your coach Virgil would say affirming words to you. And you also emphasize the importance of how we talk to young people. When you have a youth in your life, whether it's someone you're teaching, someone you're raising, and they're going off track. And I would imagine as a parent or someone that's an adult, you know, you want to say, grab them by the shoulders and shake them, right? Like, come on, man. Yep. But how do you speak to youth when they're going off track?
It's tough, you know. Every situation is different with kids. You can't, like, I just went to the, you know, several high schools last couple of weeks and juvenile hall. And you got some of what the young people are dealing with, it is universal, right? Some of the temptations and pitfalls and different things, but some of them got really unique situations at home. And it's hard to give a blanket message to everybody. You know, sometimes you gotta roll up your sleeves and really understand what somebody's struggling with to be able to advise them as best you can. But I am aware that there's only so much that I can do when I speak. And when I speak, my goal is really not even to inspire, even though that's what's going to happen in some cases. It's really to put some faith in the air, put some faith in the room, and to try to say some things that can get these young people thinking a little bit different, believing a little bit different, create some hope where they believe in me. Maybe this isn't just all I'm going to be. Maybe I am more than the family I was born into. Maybe I can see beyond my block and my 2-3-4 mile radius in my neighborhood. Maybe juvenile hall, maybe this can be a thing of the past. I try to start there, but I always end with them looking up, because my situation did not change until I humbled myself and I looked up and had a conversation with God and began to acknowledge the wrong that I had done, begin to confess the things that I needed forgiveness for. That's when I started to come to myself. That's when I started to see my life and see my situation different. Now my ears are open and I can hear the people that God has put in my life that I've been pushing away and rejecting. Now I can make better decisions, say, you know what? I don't need to go there, man. I need to stop doing that.
That's retired boxing champion Andre Ward speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was produced by Porfirio Rangel. Andre's book is Killing the Image, A Champion's Journey of Faith, Fighting, and Forgiveness. You can hear the full conversation with Janae at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hainaut Baba. Last year, 811 San Francisco residents died from accidental overdoses. It was the highest ever recorded in the city. Fentanyl is a potent synthetic opioid, normally prescribed as a painkiller. The surge in its use has prompted an increase in law enforcement crackdowns, especially in the city's Tenderloin district. So far this year, the monthly death toll from fentanyl has decreased, but the city is emblematic of failures around the country to come to grips with the opioid epidemic. Recently, KALW's Sunni Khalid spoke with Sylvie Sturm, reporter at the San Francisco Public Press, who recently wrote a series on the city's fight against fentanyl.
How did we get to where we are now, especially with fentanyl?
Fentanyl was introduced to North America, as I understand it, beginning in around 2015. It hit the shores on the East Coast around 2015, coming from China. It's fabricated in labs, and it's sort of crept its way across the country. Starting in 2017, we started seeing it in San Francisco. Right away, the overdose deaths just spiked. Unintentionally, people were taking it to begin with.
Explain that.
I think that from what I understand, people who were selling methamphetamine, cocaine, other sort of illicit drugs, they were putting it in their drugs to increase the longevity of the high. That's what fentanyl does. And so after putting it into these illicit drugs, people were taking it unintentionally, and that was creating these deaths that people were, you know, just dying in the streets, dying of overdose, accidentally taking more powerful drugs than they thought they were taking.
What is a fatal dose? How small is it?
They say that, you know, something as small as a head of a pin can kill you of fentanyl.
All right. Well, it came here in force in 2017. And what has happened every year since then?
An increase in overdose deaths, accidental overdose deaths. So people were initially taking it accidentally, but then, you know, they were intentionally taking fentanyl because, again, it increases the longevity of your high. And so people were taking it on purpose. Again, it was very, very powerful. And so people were overdosing, accidentally overdosing and dying. Until this year, we've seen the highest death ever since they started counting overdose deaths. So 806 deaths, I believe, in 2023.
And we're already ahead of that pace this year?
66 deaths in the month of January, which is not the highest deaths counted in any single month, but it's quite high.
What are health professionals telling you about this drug and how they're trying to cope with it?
Well, health professionals, they're giving people advice such as test your drugs. If you don't want to be taking fentanyl, there are test strips that you can use to test your drugs and see if there is fentanyl in there. They're saying use with friends. So if you're using, have a friend nearby in case you overdose. They're distributing Narcan, which is an overdose reversal medication that you can insert in your nose. It's a nasal spray.
And now we have a state law, which is basically providing Narcan for all of the colleges and high school campuses. I guess that shows you how serious things have gotten.
That's another issue altogether, because college kids are taking illicit pills, and fentanyl is finding its way into pills like Percocet. And so college students are ordering pills online and then, you know, overdosing in their dorm rooms.
When I was doing some research about fentanyl, since 2018, I think the FDA has estimated about 750,000 deaths in the U.S., which when you put that historically against other drugs, that is absolutely amazing. Let's deal with the demographics. I read in your reporting that about half of the people who died in San Francisco were homeless. But what is the demographic of the average victim or the average user for fentanyl?
Of the 800 or so people who have died of accidental overdose, there is about, I believe, 450 of those had fentanyl involved. So it wasn't just single use of fentanyl, it was fentanyl involved. And 70% of those had a fixed address, and about 30% of those had no fixed address. And so 30% of people who died of overdose last year were thought to have been homeless or unhoused. And there is a high percentage of those who are African-American, just an incredible rate of people, even though San Francisco has a rate of 6% of the population is African-American, 30% of the people who have died of accidental overdose in San Francisco are African-American. And also about 30% of people who are unhoused in San Francisco are African-American. And so there's a direct correlation in what I found in my reporting between being unhoused and being addicted to drugs or dying of overdose. So homelessness and overdose have direct correlation, in my opinion.
I'm an old veteran of the crack wars in Baltimore, and it became an election issue. And of course, the politicians wanted to stay in office. So it was, let's get tough on drugs. Let's just get tough on crack. The war on drugs had not been discredited to nearly the degree that it's been discredited 30 years later. And the impression or the perception that people wanted to give was that we could arrest our way out of this. How has it gone in San Francisco? Because we have parts of the Tenderloin and parts of SoMa are basically under siege by the SFPD. We have the California Highway Police, and we also have the California Army National Guard all in place. What has the law enforcement effort accomplished?
By Mayor London Breed's own admission, the intoxication detention pilot project, as they called it, which began in late May last year to arrest people in order to give them an opportunity to accept treatment, that has not been successful. So people have not taken the opportunity to enter treatment. From what I have learned through discussions with my sources at the San Francisco Drug Users Union, it's not a great method to get people into treatment, because typically police officers are not a trusted source for entering treatment. They're usually people who disrupt a community, you know, that community. So people haven't availed themselves of treatment through that method. So it hasn't been a very good way of getting people into treatment, because even through the admission of the SFPD chief, Bill Scott, and the mayor, because that hasn't been a very successful method, they've introduce a new method of trying to get people into treatment, a more coercive method, which is Proposition F, which is basically people who are 65 and under who are receiving city or county welfare. They will have to undergo screening for drug dependency. And if they want to receive their cash benefits, if they refuse to undergo screening for drug dependency and then treatment, if they're found to be dependent on drugs, they will not be able to get their cash benefits.
What do critics of Prop F think?
Well, uniformly, addiction specialists, drug policy experts, every single person on that end of the debate says that it's a bad idea. They say that it will create more homelessness, more poverty. It won't encourage people to enter treatment, people who are dependent on drugs, by losing their $100 a month if they're unhoused and their $700 if they are housed. that's not necessarily going to encourage them to quit drugs. So it's just going to end up with no cash benefits, more homelessness, and maybe even more crime.
Do you think it's unfair that San Francisco has sort of become a poster child for every social ill in the country and has become essentially a poster child for the fentanyl epidemic?
I think it's politically expedient for certain people to be able to look at San Francisco. I mean, San Francisco is only 7 miles by 7 miles, so it's a little bit of a concentrated area for that. It's hard to hide the problem. You know, Philadelphia is a really bad problem. Los Angeles has a bad problem. New York has a bad problem. But it's a little bit more sprawling and easier to hide. That's been my thought. I think that it's a political football. Unfair, yeah. It's definitely unfair to point to San Francisco and say that it's the worst place in the country for that sort of thing. But it's not doing very well, for sure.
That was Sylvie Sturm, a reporter with the San Francisco Public Press, speaking with KELW News editor Sunni Khalid. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Before we go, Bay Area author Lisa Hamilton reads from her book, The Hungry Season. It's about a woman whose life has been colored by an unimaginable loss and how she meets it with defiance and resilience. It's our pocket-sized book tour, New Arrivals.
It's an intimate biography of a remarkable woman named Ia Mua. She was born in Laos, displaced by war to refugee camps in Thailand, and now lives in Fresno, where she's a mother, a shaman, and a farmer who grows rice by hand, just as her parents and those before them did back in Laos. This passage from the middle of the book touches on how the rice she grows is something much more than just a crop to sell. The rice was a medium for memory, a spiritual bridge on which her heart could walk across all that longing and return to when she was with them both in person. It happened when the first green shoots poked through the soil, then when the leaves grew thick and wind rushed through them, when the plants miraculously flowered and then filled out the stomach of each little grain, the past that felt so far away came surging back. Ia could hear her mother and father, voices trilling with excitement. "The rice is almost ready," they would say. "Come with us. Let's go." At the farm, she could touch them again. Almost. And there was the bittersweetness. The rice brought her closer to them, while at the same time clarifying just how far away each of them really was.
That was Bay Area author Lisa Hamilton reading from her book, The Hungry Season. It came out in September. New Arrivals is produced by KELW's Lisa Morehouse. You can find that episode and more at KELW.org/New Arrivals. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.